You're listening to A Views and Brews, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. Find out how you can join us for a live show at the Cactus at cactuscafe.org.
I'm Rebecca McEnroe with KUT. I host these programs, these Views and Brews programs. So thanks for coming out for these, especially on this nice, cool evening. Tonight, we're going to talk about all kinds of things, the history of city planning, what Code Next is, what it could mean for you, all types of things. So before we get started with the discussion, KUT put together this phenomenal video with the help of David Carroll, actually. And Jorge Sanhueza León is our multimedia director. And so he did, this took like 2 weeks, right? Matt Largy's here from KUT. It took forever. There were Legos at the station for forever, for months. So you'll see, it's 2 minutes long, but it took months and months and months to actually put together. So we're just going to watch it so you can become familiar with a little bit of the jargon and the terminology around Code Next. So hit it, Jack.
Something called Code Next. It's a plan to change the building code that governs what can be built where in Austin. But people have competing views about how the city should grow, so this whole process can get controversial. But let's ignore that. To start to understand what Code Next actually means, you need to know a few basic terms. So we're going to start with five. And we're going to show you what these terms mean with Legos. We're going to build a house. Before we get our house on the ground, let's talk about something called impervious cover. It refers to any hard surface. Think roads, parking lots, driveways. The city limits impervious cover because when water can't be absorbed into the ground, the risk of flooding increases. That's why driveways can only be so long. So now we're ready to put our house on the ground. The city requires it to be a certain distance from the road and from your neighbor's lot. It's called setback. Basically, it's a cushion. Along with setback, our house also has to follow the rules for building height. Our house measures in at 4.5 Lego people tall. How tall we can build our house is also affected by something called FAR. That stands for floor to area ratio. This rule determines how much square footage we can build in proportion to the amount of land we have. Here, we have some options. Our one-story house hasn't used up all of its allowed FAR, so we can add a second story. The next question is, how many homes can we fit? This is called density, or the number of housing units within an area. For example, our single-family home can become a duplex that houses two families. That increases the density.
Got it? Great. Now when you're hanging out with your friends this weekend, you can be that person who knows a little something about Code Next. And you didn't have to read 1,500 pages of gobbledygook. We know these Lego people didn't. Take a bow, guys.
And the vocal stylings of Mr. Matthew Largy, who's right over here also. So thank you, Matt. So that's a little bit, it seems very simple, very straightforward. It's only really about how we build houses, right? So not that easy. Saida, well, you know what? Why don't I actually introduce the people who are on the panel this evening before we start our discussion. KUT's development and affordability reporter is here. She's been covering Code Next for about 2.5 years, as long as she's been at KUT. Saida Hassan, welcome.
Thank you.
Also with us this evening, architect David Carroll with Hatch, Uhland, and Owen Architects. Did I get that right? Because the "and" is actually after Hatch. Hatch and Uhland Owen. Okay, good deal. And he is also the chair of the City of Austin Design Commission, and he's vice chair of his neighborhoods plan contract team and leads AIA Austin's advocacy efforts to improve Code Next. And he is here with us this evening. David Carroll, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Also, to talk a little bit about the history of planning cities and urban design and development, we have Dean Almy. He is the Associate Professor of Architecture, and he is the Director of the Graduate Program in Urban Design. Dean Almy, thank you so much for coming this evening. And also the principal planner with the City of Austin's Planning and Zoning Department, Jen Todd. Thanks for being here. So, Saida, how do you explain Code Next to people?
Great question. So I'd say that kind of the shorthand that we've used in a lot of radio stories when we've got limited time to explain something as complex as Code Next is we say that it is the ongoing rewrite of Austin's land development code. And those are the rules that generally govern what can be built in Austin and where it can go.
Okay. So, Jen, what was the impetus of the city beginning Code Next? It was about 4.5 years ago when they started this design, right? And before that, the last code was made in 1984, is that correct?
Yes, so our last major code update was 1984.
Okay, so talk a little bit about why starting a new code right now.
So starting a new code, it came from Imagine Austin. That's our city's comprehensive plan. It was unanimously adopted by council in 2012. It has 8 priority programs, which you can check out. One of them was to rewrite the land development code, with the idea being that we can't achieve the priorities in those other programs without rewriting the land development code. So that was the impetus for beginning the project, which then went through several phases, I think starting in 2013 or 2014, going up till now, when we have a staff recommendation with city council.
And why was that necessary? Like, what was the deal?
So for rewriting the code, there were several priority programs in Imagine Austin, such as, you know, looking for household affordability, integrating nature into the city, focusing on multimodal transportation. And a lot of these priorities were things that were identified in what's called our code diagnosis. And that's a document that highlights 10 major issues with the code that we should be addressing. And these are things that you can't address without tackling your land development code. So they're not just standalone policies or programs. It's things like saying that our current code doesn't do a good enough job of incentivizing, you know, affordable housing. It doesn't do a good enough job of being less auto-centric. And so there are ways that you can tackle these problems through a land development code. It won't solve all of them, but it is an important piece to achieving those goals in other priority programs.
To provide affordable housing and increase nature and things like this. Okay.
Right.
This is beautiful. So let's talk a little bit about what a city is. Dean Almy, what is a city supposed to be for? What is this idea of urban design? Where did it come from?
Well, it goes back to the Greeks, but I would I would say that, you know, depending on what you subscribe to, there's sort of two, I think, kind of fundamental things. The first of which is, how do you begin to control the collective organization of a society, right? So land division has something to do with that, how we subdivide land, how we organize it, etc. People want to live together largely for economic reasons. The second one, which is a definition of the city that comes actually out of Scandinavia, which I like very much, is that a city is a place of meeting and choice. That is, it's a social place. It's a place where people live together and, you know, aspire to live happy, healthy lives and things like that. And that's easy to say, and we get caught up, for instance, I think we get caught up with Code Next and other similar kinds of issues in the physical condition of the city. But in the end, what I think we're really after is quality of life questions. What's it like to actually live here? How do we want to be here in the future?
And David, that's kind of where you step in, because you think a lot about neighborhoods and getting neighborhoods involved in what it means to live together as neighbors. So what has Code Next meant for you as an architect and also working within neighborhoods to get people involved in this process of living together?
Well, as an architect, you know, one of the big goals of Code Next is also to just simplify the code. That includes the format of the code. For instance, now if you're developing a piece of property that you want to find out what all the regulations are in that code, or in that piece of property, that there's several areas in the code that you have to go hunt to find those regulations. So one thing that Code Next does is it brings those all together into one location. So as a design professional, or even as a homeowner, to go to one location and understand what can be done on your property is a very valuable thing.
And So the idea behind it is, you know, to create an environment that we can all live in, to increase affordability in the city. But a lot of people who are opposed to Code Next say, or who have problems with it, say this is not increasing affordability. It's allowing developers to come in. There's not very much oversight for the buildings. So how are things being implemented and overseen as it regards to affordability in the city?
I would, you know, start by addressing one way that you get to increasing actual affordable housing is through what's called the Affordable Housing Bonus Program. And currently we achieve that through mostly density bonus programs, which allow a developer to build more building in exchange for affordable housing or a fee, which is called a fee in lieu. So that money would eventually go toward affordable housing. And so in our Code Next proposal, what you have is the Affordable Housing Bonus Program expanded in more areas of the city so that you get a greater geographic dispersion of where you can access building this affordable housing and choices for people to live. The other way of increasing options, which may or may not be affordable depending on what gets built, would be to allow for a greater variety of housing types. That opens the door for different price points. So you look at having standalone single-family homes, which we have today, allowing for more accessory dwelling units, which would be smaller. Sometimes you hear like granny flats or garage apartments on various lots, as well as allowing what's called missing middle. And that's something we don't have a lot of today. We tend to have a lot of single-family homes and then larger multifamily developments. Whereas with missing middle, you can get something kind of in between, something you see in a lot of older development patterns, or maybe you have four units in a building that more closely resembles a house, or three units in something that more closely resembles a house. And the other thing I would mention is in our Main Street and mixed-use zones, which currently are often straight commercial, now would also allow for residential. So you're getting more opportunities, again, for more people to access housing within the city.
So I was going to chime in a little bit on this. We've done some research at the university on what would be the sort of ideal affordable density for housing, given land costs and construction costs of buildings. And we came up with about 11 units per acre, which is actually significantly more dense than what Austin currently is on average. It is a form of missing middle. Austin is actually the least dense of all the major cities in what we call the Texas Triangle, which is sort of Dallas, Fort Worth, San Antonio, Houston, Austin. Austin is the least dense of all of those cities. And where it becomes problematic in terms of affordable housing is when the housing stock is not increasing at the level that the population is increasing, then housing gets more and more expensive, supply and demand. So unless we come up with a way of building housing more densely that still contributes to our quality of life, et cetera, we're not really going to be able to, I think, to tackle this question. And I think that's part of what Code Next is trying to do.
Mm-hmm. I'll chime in as well. Mm-hmm. One other aspect that the code actually affects affordability in an indirect way, not through the actual programs, but is through the cost of construction. Because the code, and through its regulations, can force a development to build a certain way or to provide, let's say, a certain number of parking spaces. And to build those parking spaces costs a lot of money, and then that money's passed on to either the buyer or the renter. So, you know, reducing the number of parking spaces, as an example, could be a way to then help the affordability issue through the construction price.
Yeah. Also, something, Dean, that you mentioned about the least dense city in Austin. I feel that part of this, when Saida and I have been talking about it and you hear stories about it, part of it is a mythology about what Austin is. It's a city that is growing rapidly, but at the same time, for a lot of people, there's a nostalgia associated with how they feel Austin used to be or what Austin should be. So what role has mythology played in the discussions around Code Next, and how do you negotiate those? Saida, maybe we'll start with you.
Sure. Well, I can talk about some of the things that I often hear from people in my reporting. And I think, as you said, Rebecca, there is, you know, kind of a push and pull between different sides of, you know, I don't think that many people would disagree with the idea of having a more affordable city or a more livable city or more walkable city even. But I think that when you start talking about the technicalities of, okay, well, where should that added affordable housing go? That's when that sort of tension comes into play of there are folks that live in, you know, perhaps neighborhoods that are dominated by single family homes today, and they may have concerns about, well, if, you know, we start adding more denser development here, what is my neighborhood going to look like? Are we going to feel a drastic change in our lives? Versus, you know, the, and I'm kind of oversimplifying here, but then there's the other side of the argument that, well, you know, we've got to find places to put this housing because, as you said, there's kind of this push and pull, supply and demand, and it's got to go somewhere.
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I was just going to say that if we don't figure out a way to incorporate more housing density into the central part of the city in some way, then we're going to be building more housing on the periphery. And Austin has always been a very environmentally conscious city, and what we're finding is that the periphery is starting to consume all those environmental qualities which are responsible for why Austin is here in the first place. So there's definitely trade-offs. I mean, in terms of history and nostalgia, I'm not a native Texan, but I moved here in 83, which is just after the Armadillo World Headquarters closed, unfortunately. And I've seen it go through a lot of changes, and some are good and some are bad, I confess. And I am nostalgic for some of the things that are no longer here. But, you know, Texas has a certain business climate. Businesses are moving here. We're encouraging, and the state is encouraging businesses to move here. People want to move to Austin. I don't think we have the ability to stop population growth. We can't just say, oh, we're not going to have it. We're going to have to figure out what we're going to do with it. And, you know, agree or disagree with what Code Next is proposing, the fact of the matter is it's trying to deal with these, like, really critical issues.
Yeah. And, Jen, what have been some of the major roadblocks for the project? I mean, 4 years seems like a while to try to put something together. So what have you kind of run up against? What have been the challenges?
So I think the primary challenge is just the scope of the project. No other city of our size has taken on a complete rewrite of their land development code. So we're kind of pioneers in this. We can talk to other folks who've done similar things in certain ways, but no one has taken on anything that we know of that's this big. And so there has been that. There's also been Austin is a very engaged population. And so there's needing to go out, we're talking to folks, needing to get a lot of input on a lot of different things from both the technical to the less technical of how do people experience a place, what do they want to maintain, where do we see opportunities to improve. And so I think, you know, the complexity is one issue, wanting to make sure we reach out to a lot of people, make sure folks are involved, make sure we hear opinions we can consider. And then there's the just troubleshooting and conflict resolution, whether it's between actual code language pieces or competing priorities where a lot is only so big. And so you can't achieve necessarily everything that you want on every single lot. So it's negotiating a lot of moving targets and trying to put together a land development code that accomplishes as much as we can.
And one thing that, you know, we hear a lot about, we talk a lot about in Austin, is gentrification. How do you negotiate the relationship between development and gentrification within the code, but also within neighborhoods, David? You know, how are you talking about that with the clients who you have and the houses that you're designing and building?
Well, I think one thing that the code can do, and that I think Code Next is trying to do, is to direct the growth more equitably across the city. I live in East Austin. I've been in East Austin for 11 years, and it was still affordable when I bought my home. And obviously today I could not afford to live in that neighborhood, but at the time it was the only place I could afford to live. And I think part of that is because the current code, you know, makes it easier to develop in that side of town and protected other areas of town. And I think if we can make it more equitable to where density could spread across all of the city, then that would ease the burden in some areas and direct it in other areas.
And Saida, what have you been hearing from people on the ground about this idea of development versus gentrification?
As it relates to CodeNext specifically, I think that, you know, there's a lot of, because of course CodeNext is still being hashed out and still being worked on at City Hall, I think that there's a lot of speculation in terms of how exactly is this going to affect my neighborhood? Is CodeNext going to exacerbate gentrification? So I think that there is some conjecture and fear, but as Jen said, you know, this is a very engaged city. I think that folks are passionate about being involved and about voicing what they hope to see, what type of changes they would like to see come to their neighborhood versus things that they think might be harmful. I did a story a while back when I talked with residents of the Runberg neighborhood that sort of talked about a lot of the rapid development that has come to that area. And I remember somebody saying that 183 is almost becoming the new I-35 in terms of, you know, the line of where that hotbed of development is. And so I remember hearing from folks there, actually some concerns about, well, is this going to open the door for, you know, these new luxury apartment buildings to come in here? And am I still going to be able to afford to live in my neighborhood? And so I think that, without sort of seeing the effects of it, there certainly is some concern. And maybe somebody else could speak to the more technical side of how you guys see this playing out on the ground.
Well, I mean, I would say that I think one of the differences between the traditional zoning code that Austin's current zoning code is based upon, it's morphed over the years, and CodeNext, which is tied to a whole series of initiatives across the country by different cities that are all trying to grapple with very similar issues that Austin has, although Austin is one of the fastest growing populations, is that traditional zoning tends to be very generic in its approach to the city and the environment, right? And I think that CodeNext, and if just the terminology that we saw in the little video, is even different, right? It tries to be very specific about what are the qualities that, let's say, might border a neighborhood, right? So actually, my personal feeling is that one of the good things about CodeNext is it actually is much more precise in trying to deal with local issues that local neighborhoods and local conditions of the city have to deal with, that just a generic sort of zoning-based approach to writing code can't actually achieve.
Okay. Yes. So, and when we're talking about affordability, I mean, what does that even mean? Is it like cities are places where people with ambition can come with very little money and work their way up traditionally, say? So is that possible now? Like we did a show a while ago with Hoover from Hoover's restaurant. And he was saying, you know, even 10 years ago, his staff worked at the restaurant, had a beer, walked home. Now that's not possible. Now the people who are working in the city live on the outskirts of the city, and it changes the dynamic of the city. So is it possible for, say, someone who's making $20,000 a year to live in downtown Austin? Not under the bridge, but like, you know, like an actual place. I mean, that when I think about it, I think, you know, when I was 18 years old, that's probably what I was making. I would love to have moved to New York. You know, I moved to London and I could live there, and I was making nothing, you know, but it was possible for me to become then. And is this a city where it's possible to still become? Is that what we want?
So I think it is a challenge. The affordability problem is a huge one here. And I think when you look at, you know, whether it's younger folks who are just getting jobs, usually you're getting paid less, it's very difficult to find somewhere to live, you often turn to, well, can I get housemates? Can I live somewhere very small? But we don't have a lot of very small units available. So you end up, I think, more often with a housemate situation. I know that's what happened to me when I moved back here. I went to grad school in Austin, moved to DC and worked for a while and came back. And my cost of living was higher for me here. And so that was a major adjustment. And I think when you look at young professionals, you can move throughout your life in different types of housing. I think a lot of people begin, maybe you're a renter. Maybe eventually you do decide that you want to buy and you move into something larger, or you still rent in something larger if you have a family. But it is becoming, as I'm sure everyone here knows, more and more challenging to find something that fits within your budget, especially at a lower income level. We do have what you call capital A affordable housing, which is often subsidized housing, but there's not enough. There's not even enough of market affordable housing, which is, you know, about what if you're making our median family income, you should be able to afford. So it is a huge challenge, and that's part of what Code Next tries to address by working at increasing the number of housing types and choices in the city, as well as creating more zones to try and be a little bit more context sensitive in terms of where you're located.
And you can make all of these codes, but then how are they implemented? You know, who oversees the implementation of these codes and makes sure that these developers are providing affordable housing? What is that process like?
So I am not as familiar with what the affordable housing enforcement looks like. That would be our neighborhood housing and community development department. They would have a more expert level answer. But I do know when you're developing code language, looking at Code Next as an example, we have multiple departments involved communicating to each other, saying what are our issues, what are proposed solutions, and how do those affect other people, as well as looking to the community. We have a lot of experts within the general city that don't work for the capital C city, and asking folks, well, what have you guys seen? What solutions have you seen? And looking at other cities and trying to identify what would be the final code language. And then a lot of the enforcement does come from code enforcement. So when you see issues, folks use, you know, the 311 app, or you call 311 to report issues. I know NHCD has their own enforcement mechanisms for affordable housing, but I just couldn't speak to those in too much detail, unfortunately.
David?
I mean, as far as building affordable housing, the code, unfortunately, cannot mandate affordable housing. There are state rules that prohibit us from doing what's called inclusionary zoning, unfortunately. But what the code can do is incentivize it. And as she's mentioned, the affordable housing program that they've spread across the city now enables that to happen, or pays the fee in lieu. For instance, right now, the program downtown, they pay the fee in lieu if they don't build affordable housing downtown to NHCD. And then an affordable developer can submit an application to them to request that money to then build affordable housing somewhere in town. So hopefully, with that spreading across town, we're going to see more of that happening.
Saida, have you run into any other problems that we haven't talked about tonight?
Oh, gosh, I'm sure I have. let's see. Trying to think. Do y'all have any thoughts on what we haven't covered yet? I know that there's...
It doesn't seem too controversial. So perhaps we open it up to the audience for
that
questions.
That sounds like a good idea.
Before we do that, Dean Alma, I have one more question. About you mentioned, Jen, that this is something Austin is doing as a very intrepid project that we haven't seen around the country. Can you think of anything that this would be similar to, another city who that has tried to implement this type of development?
This change in approach towards codes from a kind of zoning, which was based on some of the early sort of 20th century court cases about property rights, to trying to control the actual effect of the code on the physical qualities and appearance and space of the city is something that really sort of was reborn in the United States probably in the mid-80s, Seaside, right? That's where they originally wrote, like, let's try out this new idea of a code, Seaside, Florida. And it's been used by cities all around the country now. Denver, I think, and Portland, of course. But Denver has one of the most robust ones, which uses different kinds, versions of this for different districts of the city, depending on their particular characteristics. Austin's, because of the particular, we'll call it discursive climate in the city, where people are sort of taking positions and it's very active and people, you know, are vocal. Austin's is a bit watered down after 4 years from where it started, but it's probably has more consensus behind it than what some of the processes that some of the other cities have used.
Well, why don't we open things up for questions and see what's on your mind? We have one right here. I believe this lady. Wait, 1 second. You got to have a microphone or else you won't be on tape. And then we will lose you. It will be travesty.
I have a question to David and the rest of you. To increase affordability, we do that by increasing density and by reducing construction costs by reducing the number of required parking places. So more density means more cars. David, where are those cars going to park overnight?
More density doesn't necessarily mean more cars. It may mean, you know, more dockless scooters, but I wouldn't say more cars. And honestly, I'm not saying more density equals affordability either. There's not one thing that's going to be the magic silver bullet here. There's got to be lots of things that, in conjunction, can help get us to be more affordable. But there's not going to be one thing that can do it.
There's a question, a couple questions in the back, and another one in the front.
Well,
I've got the microphone.
Okay, beautiful.
I am also a local architect using the current code, and I'm curious on the application of the Code Next requirements, especially when it comes to zoning versus use. Right now, I feel like the current code is penalizing people who are adjacent to a lot that has not utilized the maximum potential of that lot. For example, multifamily zoning, but the lot is used for multifamily use. So therefore, we have to then apply compatibility setbacks on top of the regular zoning requirements to then set back the maximum building area for a multifamily home because the adjacent lot is not used for its maximum zoning potential. So my question is that simplified or is that removed? If a person decides not to build to the maximum potential of that lot, they are no longer driving the development of the surrounding lots around it.
You want to, I know the answer.
So for compatibility does still exist in Code Next when you're referring to the building types, you know, looking between uses. A big change in Code Next is that compatibility is now triggered by your zone rather than your use. So for example, under current code, you sometimes have maybe a multifamily lot or even a commercial lot that's currently a single family house. And so you would trigger compatibility because that's the use. Under Code Next, you would not trigger it because it's zoned something different. So a different type of compatibility would apply depending on what your zoning there is. The other thing is that compatibility is no longer like a standalone chapter as in the current code. It's integrated into each zone. So each zone has its own compatibility for setbacks or stepbacks.
And I could add one other thing to that. It no longer goes to 540 feet. Right? At 100 feet, you can get the full entitlement of your site under the current draft.
I have the microphone now.
Okay, go ahead.
So I liked what you asked earlier about affordability, and I think we need to define what affordability is, affordability for whom. I'm a teacher, and a lot of my students are having to work 35 hours a week and go to school full time to pay the light bill. And it's not just one or two or three, it's most of them. And so who are we talking about? Are we talking about the UT grad student who just came in here and like, you know, and one day we'll make $100,000, hopefully? Or are we talking about like, you know, the families that we are pushing out? What does affordability mean?
I think the answer to that is yes. Affordability, we're looking at the entire spectrum between, you know, the person making $20,000 a year that you mentioned to someone who is maybe a grad student or an undergrad student who's trying to support themselves with a job and working and student loans, which is very stressful in and of itself, to, you know, someone who has a family that maybe doesn't make a lot of money to afford our market rate housing. And so the answer is looking across the spectrum. Even folks who make greater than the median family income often can't afford your market rate house here. So it's looking at really trying to create opportunities for everyone. But as was mentioned earlier, the code unfortunately will not actually create the affordable housing. All we can do is create the opportunity for things to be built. Yeah.
And does the code affect students at all? I mean, it is very difficult to be a student here at UT, and we've seen the food pantries, you know, go up in need. We have the most, this is interesting statistic, the most sugar babies of anyone in Texas. I don't know if you know what that is, here at UT. You can see, I'll post the study. And so it's very difficult for people to actually live and go to school here when UT could be providing, you know, more scholarships, more incentives for students. Does Code Next affect students at all? And
yes,
student housing?
It definitely does. It affects, you know, the type of housing that can get built. It affects where housing is allowed to be built. And even looking at non-housing things, you know, the land development code, part of what makes ours unique is it's everything, including outside of zoning. It dictates, you know, where can parkland dedication be? Are you in an area where you have access to a green space? It dictates parking and transit and accessibility through the, there's a transportation demand management program. So it's saying if you're building maybe a larger development in order to build more places for people in homes, you're going to maybe provide less parking, but maybe you give transit passes to residents. Or maybe you provide more car share parking or bike share parking. And so it's looking at ways of giving people options for getting around, especially when you're looking at a student who maybe cannot afford a car. And so it's saying, how can we create a city that works for more people?
So one of the things that I'll say about affordable housing ties into, let's say, an increased choice of dwelling types, right, of residential types. So if we think about the traditional townhouse that we find in other cities, not so much Austin, you know, maybe it's three stories tall, maybe it has an alley, maybe it has a carriage house in the alley. A family could buy that piece of property, live in the top two floors, rent out the carriage house, we call it an ADU these days, maybe even rent out the flat on the ground. And all the income that's sort of generated from those, let's say, rental properties helps pay the mortgage for the family who owns the property, and at the same time provides different, let's say, classes of affordability within the density of an urban block, right? And so this requires, in order for that kind of more multivalent, integrated, affordable structure to occur, it means that land has to be subdivided a certain way, there has to be alleys, there has to be streets, and we've sort of forgotten how to build this way. East Austin was originally built that way. Some of Austin's inner urban neighborhoods were built this way. The neighborhoods we're building out on the edges are definitely not built this way. Those are actually the most difficult neighborhoods to convert into something that actually is affordable.
Another question? There's tons of hands in the back.
Yeah. Hi, guys. So this was just briefly touched on with the options of transportation for student affordability. My question pertains to, you know, the very first question with the whole fact that this city is getting more dense. And yes, there's a lot of people driving. And obviously, that density doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to have more cars. We hope not for a lot of reasons. But unfortunately, the donut growth pattern of all the burbs around Austin are some of the fastest growing cities in the entire nation. And they are driving in because we don't have any other public transit options, you know, on the table, or at least none that I'm aware of. My question is, what does this code have to say about, I guess, more transportation options? Not the silver bullet necessarily, but are there other planning options? You know, what are the array of choices?
So I can answer the within the code part. It does a couple of things. One is you do see some parking reductions in certain cases. For example, in exchange for affordable housing or for residential units only requiring one space instead of two. And where the market demands it, you may still get that full parking of two spaces or more in a house. But where the market doesn't demand it, maybe you live closer in, you might just have one space. That frees up someone to take a bus or a bike or a bike share or the scooters or something else to get around, with the idea that you're relieving some pressure in terms of giving people a different way of getting around. The transportation chapter also includes an updated transportation impact analysis, which is what a new development has to do, that takes into account a broader view of trips and transportation in a site. There's also the Transportation Demand Management Program, and that helps to incentivize offering options in a particular development for folks that, you know, you can still drive if you want, but maybe you have other options now too that aren't currently available under the current code because they're maybe not incentivized enough.
And something I'll add on to that, Jen mentioned earlier our city's comprehensive plan, Imagine Austin, and within that document, the city has identified a series of what they call Imagine Austin corridors, and these are kind of areas where there is transit, public transit, and different transportation options readily available. So one of the ideas is to focus new development along those corridors, thereby making it more accessible to the people who ultimately end up living there.
See, I think one of the things that we have to think about when we think about affordability is not just the cost of housing, but the cost of transportation, right? So if the suburbs are the new ghetto of the future, and we have to live outside, you know, let's say Taylor somewhere in order to live in Austin, we actually have quite a high transportation cost that we have to pay. Cars and, you know, the lifestyle of living outside a denser central city is actually way more expensive in terms of transportation costs. So there's this thing in mortgage finance like drive till you qualify, right? Like the farther you're out from the center, the cheaper it is. But it's actually not cheaper because you're paying a huge portion of your sort of monthly income on transportation. So we have to find a way for land use and transportation to work together. Otherwise, this isn't going to work.
And even talking about transportation, you know, I think about my commute, dropping my daughter off at school, I have to pick things up at the grocery store, go to work, coming back, doing the same thing, you know, going to events. Like, how does the code address schools, food, access to parks, things like that?
So you bring up a good question. And a phrase in Imagine Austin that speaks to that is called complete communities, with the idea that you have all of the things that you need, or most of them, within, you know, a short drive, a short transit trip, maybe you're on foot, maybe you're on a bike. And so one way the code can try to create these kinds of places is by having more flexible zoning in terms of you have a greater variety of uses allowed. One thing that speaks to this is allowing more residential units along corridors, which puts people closer to transit, which makes them closer to jobs and to school and to errands and those sorts of things, than you might be if you don't have a car and you are, you know, dependent on that transit. Another way that the code works, looking at parkland dedication, I know our parks department has a goal of within the urban core having a park within a quarter mile. So the new code speaks to whether you have parkland dedication, that's land, or are you paying a fee that then, you know, could allow the city to buy land somewhere? So the code does try to create more of these smaller, complete communities within the city, knowing that you still will have errands and things that are a larger trip, but maybe there are more things close to you that don't necessarily require a car all the time.
You know, one of the things that, excuse me, we've been looking at in terms of the sort of complete community structure is the relationship of housing to schools is a really, really important factor in public health, right? Kids walk to school, they, you know, the traditional, like, you know, through 3 miles of snow, whatever. Kids walk to school, they walk home, they socialize with kids in the neighborhood, they get to know the neighborhoods. We have to put schools back into the center of neighborhoods, but we have to have neighborhoods be dense enough so that we can populate the schools. Right, we need, AISD needs to be on board with what the city wants to do in terms of Imagine Austin.
I think
that's really critical. Not always.
Interesting. Another question?
This kind of piggybacks on what was just talked about. We talk a lot about the mix of housing going on, but we also talked about how many employers are moving to this area. So what's being done in Code Next to bring employers closer to where people are living? Because even if there's a good mix of housing, if they have to travel out into the suburbs for work, we're still going to have a lot of transportation issues. So what's being done to bring some of those bigger employers closer to where people live?
That's a good question. The code can only do so much towards actually providing space for employers. The land development code can't attract employers. Our economic development department does, though, work on that. But through the code, what we can offer is flexibility in space. So maybe you don't have to have a very large retail space in order to come in, but you still provide options for those larger employers who come and want like a campus-sized development. We have a new use called live-work in the code that would allow, you know, for some of the smaller, especially when you hear about the creative community and creative artists, musicians being pushed out due to affordability. Maybe it allows greater ability to live close to where you work. And looking at methods in that way to try and allow for employers to fit into different spaces. We hear this with grocery stores also. Maybe now, instead of having to have a very large footprint, you could occupy a smaller footprint in an area that has a grocery desert but doesn't have someone who's willing to take the risk of moving there yet.
Did you have something to add?
I was just going to add, you know, as an example, the downtown density bonus program, one of the things it requires is for projects to follow the urban design guidelines. And that really pushes for mixed use. So now what we're seeing downtown, and in fact, we just saw one a couple weeks ago in Design Commission, are buildings that are residential and commercial and office use all in one building, with the thought that there's the opportunity to live where you work.
I mean, I think one of the models that I think is really difficult that CodeNext can't really address is that there are a lot of residential areas and a lot of potential employers actually just outside the city boundary, right? The city can't regulate the region. And I think, you know, it's generally sort of agreed that one of the most affordable, sustainable modes of development is small towns. And, you know, we have these small towns in and around Austin, you know, sort of the Bastrops and the Elgins and the Mainers and the, you know, Georgetowns, et cetera, that are developing rapid populations. A lot of them are sort of becoming commuter suburbs to Austin, and a lot of the transit plans for Austin, Cap Metro, et cetera, are about getting people to the central city. But I think, unfortunately, we can't do this in Texas because it's illegal, but I think that if we start to think about these towns as actually places of living, places of employment, places of schools, we could actually, maybe they're more blue-collar, let's say, than a tech industry or something. We actually have the ability to live adjacent to central Austin, maybe participate in the culture of central Austin, but actually live in a more affordable and still somewhat of an urban environment with lots of sort of cultural things going on, but more in the guise of a town than a suburb. Some cities around the country are looking at city-county forms of governance. We can't do that here.
Another question? We have time for about two more.
So I have a question. I'm a homeowner, and my wife and I want
a casino. Hold on. Wait, one sec.
Sorry.
I heard casino, and I was thinking, really?
Casita.
Okay.
So
the mic's working.
One of those small kinds of, you know, additional units that is the middle kind of housing that you've talked about. So under CodeNext, how is this different? Is it easier? Is it harder? What is the process different? And what can you tell me about that?
Sure. So CodeNext wouldn't look at the type of additional dwelling unit you're putting in, whether it's the casita or if it's, you know, a more traditional looking garage apartment, or, you know, what your actual format is. What CodeNext would look at is what is your lot size. Currently, the minimum lot size for a house is 5,750 square feet, and CodeNext makes your minimum lot size 5,000 square feet. And in most of the residential zones, you're allowed to have an accessory dwelling unit. So through CodeNext, it's easier to achieve building one, where maybe today you wouldn't be allowed to do that as long as your lot is big enough. CodeNext also, some of the things that remain the same, looking at things like your impervious cover, like the video spoke to, how much is paved, you know, or driveway and that kind of thing, that remains the same. But I think the biggest change is the lot size and the geographic availability of having that option accessible to you.
Oh, one more question?
I guess I have the mic, so I get to ask a question. At the beginning, you mentioned how long it's been since the last code rewrite. I'm wondering if there's any kind of, I don't know, I'm in a technology company, so any kind of agile mentality to not make it so long before revisions can be made again. It seems like one of the most painful parts of this is that it feels like forever that since we did one, and then once this is decided, it will be this way forever. Is there any kind of ability to look at this again in 5 years or 10 years when there's so much growth and things could change in 5 years dramatically?
So it is not forever. What you do have, so part of what makes Code Next so different from what we've had in the past, which are code amendments, is that this is a complete overhaul rewrite of the entire code. It's re-examining the entire system and the way that the different elements work together, what are our standards. Whereas after Code Next, what you'll have are called code amendments. And those would be small changes to maybe a particular provision, maybe to a policy or a program. And then that way you can tweak the code to make it a little bit more applicable to Austin as we grow, because the future Austin won't look like what we have today. So we want to make sure that we can continue to address issues as they arise.
So as we close, I think that what you said is the future Austin, you know, and I think a large part of any type of planning mission is unifying this imagined space, this imagined place, you know. So maybe as we close, if you could just say, you know, what is the type of space you imagine for Austin in the next 10, 20 years, and what part does Code Next play in fulfilling that imagination? Saida, let me start with you.
Oh, sure. Well, based on what I've heard from the many, many people I've talked to over the past 2.5 years of reporting on this, I'd say the word that really sticks in my mind is affordability. I think that that issue is at the center of what a lot of folks have their eye on, either their ability to remain where they are or maybe their ability to purchase a home and to grow their connection to Austin down the line. So, of course, Code Next affects that issue and has the potential to change that issue in a lot of ways. So I would say that is kind of the central idea for me.
David, what type of Austin do you imagine?
Well, I would probably go back to the idea of the complete communities, to be able to have a walkable Austin. You know, in my neighborhood, like I said before, I've been there 11 years. Just recently I opened a coffee shop that I could actually walk to. You know, when I moved there 11 years ago, there was nothing around there. I had to drive across 35 to find a place to go to. So just the ability to, you know, walk my dog and go over to a coffee shop and have a drink, and to have those options nearby, I think would be fantastic. And directing that growth towards the corridors, I think will help achieve that.
So, assuming I could afford to live here then, I think my interest would be in what quality of life will I have here. And I guess what I would say is, when you look at what we get when we just follow traditional zoning, we might keep really undesirable things away, but we don't necessarily get the things we want. And when we look at what Code Next is trying to do, it's trying to change the parameters through which we evaluate development to get the things we want, to try and, as development occurs, create the qualities that we want our city to have. And of course, that's a whole other discussion. But to me, it's all about, I want to be happy here.
From my perspective, I would think the future Austin should work for everyone throughout, you know, your entire life, being a complete community for people. You know, we say from 8 to 80, where the kid has, you know, a place to go play, there's maybe a park nearby and a school, and that experience is good, all the way through the college student who maybe has greater needs, has more mobility, has a different set of needs, but can still live and work and enjoy Austin, to someone who retires and maybe now lives in the granny flat behind their larger house and rent out for income, creating a place that really does allow folks to enjoy the quality of life that Austin offers from 8 to 80.
Well, thank you all for coming out this evening, and thank you so much to Saida and David and Dean and Jen for being a part of this panel. We will continue the discussion of Code Next when it's all kind of wrapped up and completed. There's also a study coming out at the end of August on gentrification, so we will talk about that when that happens. And please continue to follow Saida's work at KUT. As for this evening, thank you very much for coming out. Our next Views and Brews will be the 24th of July, and we're going to be talking about immigration with some poets from the Valley and some writers here in town. So please join us for that, and have a wonderful evening. Thank you.